George Bush, Dick Cheney, got some free time? Well, welcome to Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Paul McInnes, and on this week's show, we'll talk dub with bass legend Jar Wobble. We'll review new music from WAVS, NASA, and an Obama-inspired effort from Q-Tip. We'll reminisce over Pavement in the feature with No Name. We'll have the best of your face back. But first, put on your dancing trousers. It's Franz Ferdinand. That was Ulysses by Franz Ferdinand, the lead single from their third album, Tonight, which you may remember we reviewed on Singles Club last week. It's been 3 years since Franz's last long player, and after the more pop-rock stylings of You Could Have It So Much Better, the band have returned their focus to the dance floor. It's been an album that's been road-tested over the past 6 months in a series of live shows, and so, when I met singer Alex and drummer Paul in a suitably poncy British deli this week, I asked them about their dance floor direction.
It's something that evolved, you know, like we weren't quite sure what it was going to be, but as we did write, we realised that that's what we loved and what we were kind of getting off on in this, and so, yeah, the sort of slowing the beats down a little bit and putting the bass more to the forefront definitely became part of the sound.
If you listen to a DJ set or like a song that's built for the dance floor, it doesn't have the dynamic of a rock and roll song. It doesn't have like the introduction, verse, chorus, that kind of like snappy. It has this, like a much longer dynamic build. And so it has this more mesmeric, hypnotic kind of quality to it. And that's something that we wanted to explore on this record, which we hadn't really on the previous records. Outsiders at the end of the second record was kind of going in that direction. And we certainly took it that way when we played it live. But this record, we really fully went with it.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about taking the songs out on the road, and that there's been certain things that you've played and you've seen the reaction from the crowd has told you, well, maybe this one isn't for this album.
As soon as you play a song live, you know whether it's working for you or not, and like the crowd doesn't have to say anything, you just know if it's right or not just when you perform it. I think that's part of the evolution of a sound is taking them out. And we kind of wrote this album in a very similar way to the way we wrote the first album. So instead of writing a complete set of songs for a record, you'd have a gig plan. You'd say, right, okay, we've got a gig in 4 or 5 weeks' time. Let's write a bunch of songs for it. So we'd write some songs for that gig, and then another gig in a few weeks' time. And so it's more of a gradual evolution rather than like this grand concept of what the sound for the record is going to be. Because it doesn't fall out of your head complete like that. I think like maybe Ulysses is a good example. You kind of think, oh, right, okay, there's some of the elements of this song are kind of a little different, and then that sort of maybe would affect what she came for. And because he did that, I Can't Stop Feeling suddenly changed, which suddenly changed Turn It On, and like as each song changes, it affects the way that you hear and play the other songs.
How much improvisation was going on in the sessions?
Quite a lot more so than before, I think. More so, certainly, the previous record.
I mean, is that something that came out as the sessions went on? Were they, when you started recording the album, was it a bit more formalised, or was it always there?
There was a... Lucid Dreams kind of came about in a funny way. Like the melodies for it came about from a really long, improvised synthesizer session, an hour and a half like session with drum machines and synthesizers. We took some of those melodies and then applied them to this song that I'd been working on. And then that kind of got cut down. We kind of edited it down to this more conventional Franz Ferdinand sounding song, which we released as the version like earlier in the summer last year. And we kind of listening back to it and thinking like, no, we... By losing the sort of like the electronic experimental side of it, we were losing sort of like kind of what was exciting about it and what was turning us on about it. So we went back more in that sort of direction. There's a presumption that because music is electronic, it's somehow cold and calculated. But you don't have to create it in that way. The final section of that song was improvised. That's a one-take version of that piece of music. Paul's percussion's a one-take piece as well. It can be instinctive, spontaneous, of the moment.
So tell us about the production on this song, because on this album rather, because it sounds a lot more beefed up, a lot richer.
It's funny, like it's richer in some senses, but there aren't many layers to it. You know, it's not like a lot of contemporary records we have like 15 layers of guitars and lots of sparkle at the top end. It's richer in the sense that the bottom end is very heavy, like the bass end. It has more of the sort of like frequency response of a dance record. Again, like it's the bass end which is really leading the record. The way that we performed as well is much more about the kind of hypnotic live performance. So we became obsessed with the idea of like the way the JBs would record. They would like so play and play until they were locked into a song. So it might be like a 20-minute session for a 3-minute pop single. And so you would just edit out the bit where the band were at their tightest, like really playing hard and together. And so we'd do that. So, and again, it's kind of a rejection of contemporary recording techniques.
Catherine, kiss me. Flick your cigarette, then kiss me. Flick your eyes at mine so briefly. Your leather jacket lies in sticky pools of cider blackberry.
For me, what makes lyrics and a vocal delivery interesting is when you have a clashing sense of emotions and mood. Like with Catherine Kiss Me and Know You Girls, I wanted to take the same subject and deliver them with a different voice, like almost the way that we have different personalities within us. And so that both those songs are about remembering kissing somebody for the first time, and how we remember a big emotional event like that in different ways, depending on where we are. And so, Know You Girls is like this, song like an anecdote, you know, where you're kind of confident and everything becomes a little more glamorous than it actually was, and you become the hero of the story. There are songs like Send Him Away or Turn Him On, where I try to take over different personalities and try to think of like how the hell is somebody else thinking within this situation. Like Turn It On's the obsessive stalker song, which I've never been myself, but I'm totally fascinated by those characters. Like what makes them be like that? Like Send Him Away is more about the people who attempt to have open relationships, and the idea of like walking upstairs to your girlfriend or wife's bed when she's just sent away her other lover, like trying to convince yourself that it doesn't really matter because you're intellectually superior to the passions of the human heart, but realizing that of course it's absolute bollocks. It's bollocks. Of course you're gonna feel jealous, you know, like there's no way you can't.
The image, the public image of the band was the glamorous Franz Ferdinand, and it seemed you retreated to a kind of a junkie squat and a major HQ. Was that something you felt you had to do to retreat away from all the front line, the glamour?
It's funny when you talk about like the public perception of us being like the glamorous successful band. It's that kind of still shocks me in a way, because that's so far removed from how I see myself.
I still can't order food in a restaurant without being really apologetic about it.
And also what you're talking about is a media perception of the band, and I know there was a really strong desire within us to remove ourselves from the media. Yeah, so we did. We sort of disappeared off to Glasgow, boarded up the windows and yeah, hid ourselves from the world.
This Xenomania thing.
Yeah, everybody wants to.
Everybody
about
wants to know about it.
Xenomania. Because we spent about not quite 2 weeks, like just a few days, hanging out with the Xenomania guys. We spent pretty much the same time hanging out with James Ford, but pretty much the same amount of time hanging out with Errol Alkin as well.
So this is kind of what like a work. A workshop.
It's just experimenting, like a little bit of collaboration, you know, like you know, and we have respect for all of those different people. Like, for one reason or another, it didn't work. Like James was about to go off on tour with The Last Shadow Puppet, so we couldn't really make a record with him. And then, yeah, Xenomania, it didn't really work out. We have different methods of making music. They write songs for other people to perform.
we write songs for ourselves to perform. You know, that's the essence of why it didn't work. And we thought we could maybe kind of get over that maybe they wouldn't write for us, but we could work together. But I don't think they were really comfortable. They wanted to write the songs, and we didn't want them to write the songs. That's it. That's all it was, you know. Fair play to them. They've made some great songs, made some god-awful songs, like so many other bands. You know, but the great moments are wonderful.
That was Paul and Alex from Franz Ferdinand, and Tonight is out on January the 26th. Okay, I think it's time to bring a bit of Rosie Swash into the mix. Hello, Rosie. That was my mix noise. Hello, Rosie. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm all right, too. Thank you very much. I want to ask you a question, actually, Franz Ferdinand related. Paul from Franz Ferdinand.
Yes.
He has a huge, big tattoo on his neck. Like, it's really visible, even when he's got a big collared shirt on. It's of a rose, and it's got the name of his girlfriend on it and loads of thorns and barbed wire. Is that in any way a good look?
Yes.
It is?
Yes.
Because I just thought, you know, even in a swanky place like we were in, I thought people might be starting giving spare change.
No.
Why is that? Why is that a good look? Is it just kind of manly or something?
It's quite manly. All it needs now is to have the word swash on it. That'd be brilliant. That'd be perfect.
That's all you asked for. All right. Well, got to move on quickly because it's such a packed show today. So, C'est du temps pour le club de singles, maintenant. And sitting next to me is Casper Llewellyn-Smith of Observer Music Monthly Infamy. Hello, Casper. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. Glad to hear it. Anything of note to relay before we get into the music?
No, I don't think so. We'll get along nicely.
Let's not interrupt our prime directive, which is to play new music, even if the following track happens to be a couple of months old. Anyway, our first track is inauguration themed, at least. It's Q-Tip and J Period, and it's called Q-Tip for President.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
I want to welcome y'all to this inauguration. So happy to see y'all vote across the nation. My opponent didn't want it cause he lost his grip, pandering to all the ladies by choosing a chick. He catches attitudes, he blows a fuse often because of all my eloquence and cool. They say I'm soft and picture that, showing y'all visions to see. Period is my constituent, he nominates me.
That was Q-Tip for President by Q-Tip and J Period. Q-Tip is the main man from A Tribe Called Quest, who made something of a comeback with his Renaissance album last year. And he's got a voice like he's put a clothes peg on his nose. J Period, meanwhile, is a hip-hop producer and the latest of a long line of J's. Jam Master J, Jay-Z, J-Live, and J from Out of Five. This song was released on the internet at the end of last year, but has been doing the rounds again because, you know, it was the inauguration of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States of America this very week. I picked this track, and I don't think it's like the best thing in the world ever. And it's great beat and everything. A classic, Eric B and Rakim, Eric B for President, if a little bit too chopped up in this version. Neither am I too sure about some of Q-Tip's lyrics, particularly when he's kind of talking, I presume, about Dick Cheney, saying that he was pandering to all the ladies by choosing a chick. Pandering, not sure about that choice of verb. That said, it's great to hear that voice with that beat. Oh, and Q-Tip's voice is good too. I also think, really, though, that this shows that the internet has really helped hip-hop. Rappers have always written songs quickly, but they used to bundle them together on albums, which were not always worth the money. The MP3 release, however, is more timely and cheaper for the consumer. That's what I think. Rosie, what do you think?
I think about this track, I quite like it. Is it freestyled? Is it, do we know?
Yeah, well, that tends to be what J Period does. He kind of brings in these people to do freestyles, but a freestyle... What is a freestyle?
You know, yeah, if you know you're going to do it.
Exactly.
I think compared to the when we were reviewing the Renaissance, I feel like this the sort of vocal dexterity on this is very good, and I like it. It certainly beats some of the other rappers' efforts. For example, the one that I personally don't like, the Young Jeezy. My president is black. My Lambo is blue. So, my Lamborghini, I've got a big sports car and also the president. Wow, I see the connection there. No, I don't see the connection there at all. I think this is a lot better than that.
Particularly not after the inauguration speech where he's talking about putting away childish things, etc., etc.
Exactly.
Have you seen, Casper, have you seen this video of Jay-Z's remix of My President is Black?
I've seen the video of it. I mean, I'm sure everyone wants to get in early saying they're a bit over Obama already. I feel your point is a very good point about the speed at which things can come out. But over the last couple of days, I've kind of gorged on Obama songs and seen the Jay-Z thing, which is great, and it's a great bit of footage, but equally I'm sort of over it already, and I'm fed up with people making songs about me. I want to get on with it. You know, and be a bit more honest. It just seems like a great marketing tool for rappers at the moment to say, as it is for graphic artists, whoever, you know, attach your name to a barmer in any kind of way, and it seems like, you know, the thing to be doing.
Anything remarkable or noteworthy about this tune musically for you?
Well, I love Q-Tip. I mean, it's kind of, yeah, it's good to hear him, and it's all right, isn't it?
It's all right. It'll do a job, and hey, it's timely. But that's probably enough for Q-Tip. You can find Q-Tip for Present online in a variety of places, including download.com/music right now. Next up on Singles Club, it's Wavies, which I'm sure I'm pronouncing wrong, with So Bored. That's So Bored by Wavies. Wavies is actually Wather, in that he's Nathan Williams, a resident of San Diego, California, who cites as his influences the Beach Boys, Beat Happening and the Wipers. The 22-year-old sound is sometimes described as beach punk, which could only really be a California thing, because in England, punks like to hang around at bus stations. This is Wather's debut single. It's coming out soon, but oh, young Nathan, he doesn't need the man to shift his wares. He's already taken advantage of modern technology by releasing an EP himself on cassette. Rosie.
Yes.
Your choice.
Yes. Probably not a surprise to anyone that's ever listened to me talk about how much I like noise pop before. I thought it was pronounced Waves, but I might be wrong.
I'm sure it's pronounced Waves.
I don't
waves.
Know.
I just like the sound.
Yeah. Oh, I like how you like to uniquely pronounce band names anyway.
Okay, thanks.
I've always appreciated that. But he sounds very much like No Age, and actually has been playing shows with him and is part of the Smell crowd. I guess what I like about this song in particular is just, it is that amalgamation of like hardcore riffs and lots of dissonance and distorted vocals. And I really like the refrain, "I'm so bored," over and over again, because it's kind of lame and it ends up sounding a bit childish, but it's that kind of thing that always crops up in pop music, that people appropriate that phrase to kind of say, "I'm bored with culture too, so yeah, therefore I'm different." I just really love it, you know, this kind of the droning and the droning tonality of it. It kind of fills the track, all the space in the track is filled with noise, and for some reason that just really strikes a chord with me, and I find it really hypnotic.
Strikes a chord with me too, but I can't think why. Because to me, if I think about it detachedly, it sounds like Broken Social Scene to me. The melodies remind me a lot of Seven. Oh, I can't remember the name of EP now, but one of the ones I released a couple of years ago, just Scuzzed Up, and it feels familiar in that way. Casper, what are your thoughts?
I think it's a terrible racket, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. It sort of feels like it could have been made at any point in the last 30 or probably even 40 years now to me. It was all right, does its thing, but I wouldn't get out of bed for it in the morning.
No. Why do you think it kind of hits you there, Rosie?
Well, that's what it's just what I was saying, but I was thinking about it today. I thought, why do I really particularly like this kind of stuff and No Age, and what is it that I like? Because in a sense, there's not really much going on musically. There's not loads of arrangement and loads of different instruments, but there is, because what that kind of that kind of dissonance does, and the use of sound and reverb and that scuzz that you were talking about, is it fills up every space. There's no silence on the record, there's no space, and for some reason I just really like it. It seems to hypnotize me in a way.
Am I right in thinking he's signed now to Fat Possum, that label?
Well, this is out on Young Turks, so I don't know.
It might be Fat Possum in the US.
It's been an exciting bidding war. Anyway, they've moved on from old.
I can't
and now
see
possibly
it selling.
I'm not
going to say I can see it selling a lot of records. But anyway.
Well, that is So Bored. I've written it with two R's there. That was clever, wasn't it? By Wavies. And that's out on Young Turks in the UK on March the 2nd. Our final track on Singles Club this week is NASA with Tom Waits and Cool Keith. It's Spacious Thoughts. 69ers from the designers, Tom McCann above the hill, next to my man, Lou Man, the cardigan sweaters. They still sell the new eras now at True Man. Gato Buddha in the second set, breaking out in a cold sweat. I'll meet you in the music. We meet in the music, those we've never met. Dancing like there's nobody watching. That's Spacious Thoughts by NASA with Tom Waits and Cool Keith. Sadly, this is not the first electro-funk project from the National Space Agency. Rather, a collaboration between two producers, Sam Spiegel and Z Gonzalez, a.k.a. Squeaky Clean and DJ Z-Gon. Together they are NASA, and they've made a Biley funk-flavoured album that's most notable for its guest appearances, with everyone from David Byrne to Karen O to Soy Hog to Kanye West. Another bad piece of pronunciation. Casper's looking at me with schoolteacher eyes. They all pop up, and there's more and more and more on the album. Just how did they get all those many names to appear? That appears to be the big question. Nobody knows, but if it was blackmail, I'd certainly like to see the photograph. Right, Casper.
I don't absolutely love this either. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing, this. The whole NASA project feels almost like it's a kind of Chris Morris conceptual joke, and it's these kind of Shoreditch hipsters winding people up. Sam Spiegel claims to be Spike Jones, the filmmaker's brother, for example. It's a kind of, you feel almost a bit suspicious about the whole thing. And the cast is this stellar cast, the fact they've got Tom Waits on there, and it's kind of, you know, a fantasy pairing with Cool Keith, these two nut jobs. And if you think you're going to take two people from very different areas of music and put them together, it's a kind of lovely dream pairing. So I'm kind of intrigued by the whole thing. I think it's an interesting concept. And actually, I do like this track because I just like it when Tom Waits comes on and growling in this kind of mad, grumpy neighbour, kind of quite scary fashion.
It's like he's inherited the mantle of Old Dirty Bastard or something, but he isn't.
It
actually
is. Old Dirty Bastard is also on this record, even though he's been not only old, but actually dead for quite a while now. Further proof of their pulling power. But yeah, he is like that. And he sort of almost raps on it as well. I mean, he's with the flow.
Yeah, for me, that's the thing that I like about this tune, this Tom Waits' guest appearance. I think the music is something, again, could have been made any time in the last 20 years, maybe. It reminds, I think, the Brazilian half, Z-Gon, if he is real, who knows, used to be in a the Brazilian equivalent of Cypress Hill, and it does have that kind of flavour to it.
And was a professional skateboarder as well. The whole thing feels a little bit, it feels a bit Shoreditch, do you know what I mean? But
totally Mexico.
There's quite a lot of this around. I'm holding in my hand, you'll all be able to see that on the old podcast.
Yeah.
The album from the Brighton Port Authority, which is Norman Cook's new thing, and it's a very similar enterprise, really. This has got Iggy Pop guesting on it, Justin Robinson, Jamie T, Martha Wainwright, Dizzy Rascal, and David Byrne again, who suddenly seems to have spent a lot of time guesting on people's records.
So how does this work? How would they go about pulling, unless we kind of do imagine that it is a sinister record company conspiracy and it's the people at the heads of every of one of the five major conglomerates pulling in favours, how would you go about getting such a broad range of
people? Well, I don't know. The NASA thing is being released, at least in the States, by Anti, the record label that Waits is signed to. So I don't know if there's a bit of high-level chicanery there. They're just well-connected people. You know, it's also that slight touch of the Ronsons, though. It's music these days being made by people's address books, and it's, I suppose, that comes out of hip-hop culture, an idea of people kind of scrolling through their BlackBerry till they find a famous name and calling them in the middle of the night to do it. It's sort of slightly off-putting at some level, but
yeah, this works. Even Ronson, though, we only managed to get about three names you recognise and fill the rest with Daniel Merriweather. Anyway, Rosie.
Yes. What do I thought? Think?
Yeah, sorry. We kind of
We were going to be doing the NASA one with David Byrne. But that's okay, because you just mentioned David Byrne, and we were saying, how did they get those people? But he's a bit of a, you know, he's all over the place at the moment. He did that thing with Dirty Projectors, which I loved, the Knotty Pine track, which was really good. I think NASA in general, I guess I'm the same as Casper, I'm intrigued by it, and I think it's an interesting idea. But and in Touches, I think there's a bit of George Clinton in there, maybe Bootsy Collins, but in the sum of its parts, it's not, and it doesn't, I don't love it.
George Clinton being another guest elsewhere on the album.
Listen, they've got Chuck D, Seo Hoje. He's someone you'd enjoy pronouncing.
I just tried him. I did it better.
Spangrot, MIA, Licky Lee. That's another good pronunciation. Santa Gold, John Frusciante from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I mean, it's a bit nuts, the whole thing.
It's just crazy. It's too much. Anyway, that's NASA. And both tracks we discussed will be on the Spirit of Apollo album, which is available everywhere on February the 17th. Right, your comments on last week's singles now, and high praise indeed for Fever Ray. Indrossi said, Fever Ray is fantastic, there's no doubt there. I'm really enjoying it and hoping it gets a vinyl release along the way. Who knows, maybe Wavis will put it out on cassette. Mozwerk said, oh, that Fever Ray song sounds stunning. I hadn't listened to Silent Shout, that's the Knife's album for which Fever Ray is a spin-off, I hadn't listened to Silent Shout in a long time until a group of Germans stuck it on in a hostel I was staying in Krakow over New Year's.
Sounds like an Eli Roth film, doesn't it?
Definitely. Good to appropriate soundtrack. Rob Hakimian, pronunciation problem alert, posted on our Facebook page, Scott Walker's The Drift is certainly spookier than The Knife. We had all observed that The Knife were among the foremost practitioners of spook in pop. I dare you to listen to that album through headphones on your own in the dark. If anybody is willing to take up that challenge and post back, we'll be listening and you might feature on next week's pod. So we want your reviews of this week's tracks. That's NASA, Q-Tip and Wavis. And you can post them on our blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/music or indeed on Facebook too. Thanks to Casper for coming in to join us for Singles Club today.
Oh, it's been brilliant.
Hasn't it? It really kicked off there. It went spontaneous for a minute. We were off. Oh, discussion floor. And seeing as we've already discovered you've got nothing to tell us about your life, we won't go there again. But we hope to see you soon and we look forward with keen anticipation to the next edition of Observing Music Monthly. Having done such amazing web traffic for us last Sunday.
It's full of you too, the next one. That may or may not be a good thing.
Yes.
That's a good thing.
Yes, a good thing. There you go. All right, cheers again, Casper. No time for hanging around though. We've got a jar wobble waiting. That's Public Image Limited featuring our second guest, Jar Wobble, on bass. Wobble was the bassist in PIL and a foremost proponent of dub music in the UK. But he was a lot more and continues to be a lot more than that, eh, Rosie?
This is true. It's not an understatement to say. It's not an overstatement to say that he's one of the most interesting musicians in the UK. He was, apart from starting off with as bassist with Public Image Limited, he went on to collaborate with 70s cosmic rappers Can. He was lead musician with dub/world music influence 90s group Invaders of the Heart, former East End cab driver and London Underground employee. This is later in the musical career. He also happened to collaborate with Sinead O'Connor and he was the best friend with Sid Vicious, which is why we started talking to him about a documentary he's made called In Search of Sid, and here he explains why he felt compelled to make it.
I had the idea to actually honour him simply because he's, over the years, he's been seen as become an icon, obviously, the absolute icon of that time. And having known him, I felt it would be nice to actually honour the bloke that we all kind of knew. And I got lazy in my thinking about him and just dismissed him as this bloke I knew for a little while that had become a junkie and that was it. And there wasn't much to say. And he was, because he was determinedly sort of negative for the last year or two of his life anyway. He was a nuisance towards the end. On the very last occasion I'd seen him, I'd stopped him mugging somebody. You know, so it wasn't, you know, so to be quite honest, I haven't got sort of, you know, tremendously pleasant memories of him or Nancy. And I don't think you'd find anyone who does. I suddenly kind of wave of, actually felt quite emotional suddenly, because I suddenly remember that he hadn't come from London originally. He actually came to London by way of Bristol. And I suddenly started thinking about the first time I'd been to his flat, that the flat that he lived, he had in Queensbridge Road. And I remember his mum banging up. You know, she was injecting drugs and he was injecting drugs. I think he was injecting speed and she was injecting heroin. And I remember kind of thinking, my God, you know, imagine leaving Tunbridge Wells and going to, you know, the Queensbridge Road.
Just round in Hackney.
In Hackney. To come into there at that age could be quite daunting. So it got me thinking that it'd be nice to kind of honour him.
Did you find it to be a very cathartic experience for you?
Yes, I did. I kind of suspected it would be that way, and it really, really did, yeah. I think because of a lot, I had quite a few battles in the process of making it, that you get very kind of tired and emotional, you know, having to sort of stand your corner all the time, you know. But yes, I did. I felt a huge wave of compassion. If you hear it, the documentary, you know, you hear there's a bloke called Terry Penton I interview, And he put Sid up for a while when his mum kicked him out at age 15. And she just sort of obviously couldn't have, she wasn't, I don't think she was a good mum. I think she was a very damaged person probably. And she, you know, she's drug addicted. So not, she's not going to be an ideal mum. And I'm not looking to, yes, she was why he was, you know, although you can't help but kind of think it's an extremely major part of the equation. But I'm wise enough to know that, you know, people don't choose to be bad mums, you know. But he never really had a chance. He was a very sort of very suggestible bloke. And of course, Sid sort of, I think he got, you know, he took it all a bit seriously. I think he, this whole thing of, yeah, you know, wearing a swastika and, you know, being completely, you know, destructive is great. It's great to be, you know, it was this whole postmodern thing. It's great to be completely, to be complete rubbish and completely worthless is great. I mean, he got into this whole thing. I remember talking to him about that, you know. And, nobody had Sid's best interest at heart, you know. His real name was John, by the way. So we were all Johns. Yeah. So he's really, he only became Sid really as the punk thing started.
And is it true that he gave you your
He gave me my stage name.
Where did it
my real name's John Wardle, and he, because he knew I loved reggae, so Jar, John Jar, Wardle Wobble. So he was drunk, and I can vaguely remember it. We'd been out drinking. I remember coming back to a squat drunk, and he'd said, "Jar Wobble." And I remember saying, "Yeah, I'm going to keep that. I'm going to keep that," you know. And I remember saying, "I'm going to play bass." And he said, "You could see." I said, "I'm going to be a bass player. That's what I'm going to be."
So you didn't play bass at that point.
I would dib and dab. I borrowed his bass, and he would say, "You're useless." And I used to say, "No, you're useless," because all he ever wanted to do was play really fast Ramone stuff. And I wanted to play really slow, half-time, kind of reggae-flavoured sort of stuff. So I used to say, "You're rubbish," and he used to say, "No, you're rubbish." And a mate of mine got hold of a bass for me. I must have been 17, something like that. My mate Ronnie, he was a bit of a geezer. he got hold of a bass for me. This horrible high-action copy bass, which I would lean against the headboard of the bed to get a sound. So it was really awkward. But I actually developed some theory about playing, and I, you know, which was based on the dots. It was visual. It was based on the dots on the frets, on the fretboard, of doing geometrical shapes. And by so doing, you become determinedly modal, actually. You end up playing these ancient modes, I kid you not, that sort of they would have played probably in ancient Greece, rather than playing the root chord to a C major or something, you know.
So The names, the stage names, carried over into Public Image Limited.
Yeah, I kept it, and so because of John, I got into Peel, and after having this horrible little Music Man copy bass with very high action, leaning against the headboard, suddenly I'm taken to the Soho Sound House, and where I'm bought this sleek black Precision Fender Precision bass. So it's like sort of being given the keys to a sort of, you know, top class Ferrari or something, you know. As a, you know, it was fantastic. So that's it. And I was away. I was playing properly.
You're credited with giving Pill its dub feeling. How did you get into reggae music, and how did it come to mean a lot to you?
Very simple. It wasn't a case of, you know, of having to look very hard. It was the urban street music. Up at Whitechapel Station, there was a record shack, Paul's record stall, and they had what they called a blue beat chart. So every record in the main pop chart had a blue beat ska counterpart. And I actually preferred the ska kind of, especially the instrumentals on the B side of the ska records of the big Tamla hits of the day. I kind of like that rock steady vibe, and that's why I love reggae. Was the most natural music to me, and I stayed with it. I never lost it, even when it died away from the charts. And then, of course, came back 74, completely like reinvented with dub. And that's when suddenly echoes were being used, the bass was to the fore, speaker technology was such you could now have these 22-inch reflex bass bins that could really push air, you know. With Jamaican sound systems, and then you had people over here with sound systems, and you'd feel that bass pushing you, and that was just, to me, it wasn't music, it was a movement of God or something to me. It was just the movement of the cosmos.
That was Jar Wobble, and In Search of Sid, his documentary about Sid Vicious, is available to watch on BBC iPlayer, and Jar Wobble and the Chinese Dub Orchestra album is out now.
Thanks very much, Rosie. Right, we missed out on a feature with no name last week, so we're making up for it this. Pavement were one of the most, if not actually the iconic indie band of the 90s. As such, they helped to form the musical taste of many a youngster, and that includes the guide's Will Dean, who tells us quite why here. Everybody's going on.
Picking Pavement for the feature with no name is, I admit, a bit like that scene in Juno where, in an effort to impress Jason Bateman's character with a knowledge of obscure 70s rock, she puts all the young dudes on the stereo, only for Bateman's character Mark to tell her that he danced to it at his prom. Pavement are probably one of the most critically heralded bands of the last 20 years, but to me they still feel like my own little secret, my own Mott the Hoople. With impeccable timing, I first discovered the band when I was 15, a year after they split up. A friend had lent me their fourth record, Bright in the Corners, and while it wasn't quite a Sex Pistols at the Free Trade Hall moment, the self-reflexive charming tracks like Stereo certainly opened my eyes to a world beyond my own post-Britpop record collection. List the qualms you have, and if they stick, they will drown you in a creek, in the neck of a woods that was populated by tired nation on the fly. Everybody knows advice that was given up for free. Lots of details to discern. Having emerged unfully formed in 1989 as a studio project of Steve Malmsteen and Scott Camberg, the band, with original drummer slash 30-year-old party boy Gary Young, recorded what would become debut album Slanted and Enchanted in Young's studio. Released on Drag City, the album's release was so unheralded at the time that Malmsteen was shocked to see it in a record store as he backpacked around Europe. It was a noisy, raw, smart rock record that evoked comparisons with The Fall and The Velvet Underground. But a hint at the band's more melodic future records was to come on the Watery Domestic EP. This followed Slanted and introduced Mark Eibold and Bob Nastanovic to the lineup. Its best moment was the wonderful Frontwood. The joys of the band's records, particularly 1994's Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain, was Steve Malmsteen's wonderfully idiosyncratic lyrics. At first listen, most of them seemed easy to interpret, with references to wicket keepers, rival bands and car thieves, but they often became riddles that Malmsteen himself might not know the answer to. As the New Yorker's Alex Ross said in a 1997 piece on the band, at least one long and winding road to hell is paved with interpretations of rock lyrics. And he was never more right than with Malmsteen. I mean, my personal favourite is Stop Breathing, which is ostensibly a song about a tennis player at the US Open telling everyone to be quiet. You know, stop breathing. But according to Malmsteen, it's a tennis-based metaphor for the Civil War, and, you know, we'll have to trust him on that. After Crooked Rain and the minor radio success of Cut Your Hair, Pavement stood on the cusp of mainstream crossover. They played Lollapalooza in 1995, only to be pelted off stage with mud by Cypress Hill fans. The record they were returned with after that was Wowie Zowie, a willingly difficult response, a fragile, beautiful, but insouciant record that opened with a line about castration. It seemed an unlikely way to the Clear Channel Millions. Because of this, Rolling Stone called them afraid of success, but Pavement effectively sealed up a dedicated fanbase and kept the fickle mudslingers at bay. Having got that out of the system, Malmsteen & Co. emerged with their poppiest moments yet with 1997's Bright in the Corners and 99's Terror Twilight. But by this point, Malmsteen seemed to be frustrated with the musical shortcomings of some of his bandmates. So, while Damon Albarn was doing his best to introduce new fans to the band with 1997's Pavement's Blur record, and tracks like Stereo and Shady Lane were getting MTV spins, the band was slowly drifting apart. They bowed out with a half-simmering, half-playful Terror Twilight in 1999 to the heartbreak of fans, playing a final show at the Brixton Academy. They never did quite reach the major leagues, and to be honest, they probably didn't want to, and for that they deserve nothing but respect.
That's about it for this week. But before we go, a quick rush through some of your faceback.
We've got new friends to say hello to, including Martina Klisovic, Rodri Jervis. I can't believe these are
I've given you your own pronunciation nightmare.
Aquella Promotion, John Burko Berkovic, Danny McElveny, Richard Vernon, Ali Sohi and Andrew Khan.
I think Andrew claimed the illustrious title of 703rd friend, by the way, so well done to him. On the blog, there was lots of random dispute as to the merits of Lil Wayne.
Well, Chaz and Dave had this to say about the Virgins. Rosalite meets the Kooks, which in my books isn't a good thing. One lacklustre band is enough. I vote banish both Kooks and Rosalite and keep the Virgins. At least their rootsy Americana sound is genuine.
Rootsy Americana? I have to agree to disagree there, Chaz. But I'm with you all the way on your description of our first ever guest as just jack-off. Though I suspect that's what he brought the entourage for. Anyway, head to guardian.co.uk/music/music blog to post your thoughts on Franz and Jar and everything else in this show. While you can do the same on Facebook. It's crazy. Search Music Weekly to become a fan or Guardian Unlimited Space Music to become a friend. That's it till next Friday. Register now on the site or at iTunes to get the podcast sent straight to your computer or MP3 player for free. guardian.co.uk/music is the place. Thanks to Rosie Swash.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. And we'll be back next week. Bye.